This I believe. I believe that life is a journey and it is best lived with love and forgiveness. I did not choose my starting point or my first understandings, but along the way, as new information was learned and new understandings were shared, I had choices to make about where my journey would take me. There was a time that I thought I would arrive, finally, no more learning. Whew. And I even sort of was looking forward to that. But I am so grateful that that was not part of the creative being, and that even at my age, I can continue to have opportunity to learn and to adapt with new knowledge and to continue my journey. In the book, Jesus Before Christianity, Albert Nolan writes about historical objectivity and seeing the truth of the past in the light of the present. He says the current perspective is not necessarily better than an earlier one, but it sometimes happens that one situation has striking similarities with the situation of the distant past, and one is suddenly able to see that past situation with much greater clarity. When this happens, I think of it as an aha moment. And I had such a moment when reading about reparations and discovering God's act of reparations in Exodus, chapter 12, verses 34 and 36. The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people, and they gave them what they asked. I recently learned that historically, Jewish rabbis, as noted by Rabbi Aryeh Bernstein, have looked at the freeing of the Israelites from Egypt as an act of reparations, God's directed act of reparations. The Jewish people had worked for 400 years under abusive treatment, receiving no money for their work. It sounds familiar, right? Roughly the same amount of years and treatment as the African Americans in this country. God led the Jewish people to freedom and directed them before leaving to ask Egyptians for gifts of wealth, which were given to them and which were due them for their many years of unpaid labor. We have precedent, biblical precedent. That seems very powerful to me. I believe part of the work of reparations is learning about white supremacy, what it is, how it permeates everything. I did not choose to deny people opportunities or wealth or safety or good health care. I believe if someone told me, "You may have this good life, Marty, but you should know it is at the cost of people who will be denied the same good life," I would have said no. I want to believe that is true. I believe learning about white supremacy can be difficult. It can be difficult to see because it is so pervasive, and it can be difficult to see because it is painful. I will have to change some ideas, some understandings. I will have to ask for forgiveness, and I will need to forgive myself. Authors of the book Reparations describe white supremacy in its simplest form as a failure to love, and reparations as honoring our connection to one another, as an expression of love. As a follower of the God of love, I choose love. I believe we, here at CMCL, are a part of a new movement, an awakened movement. I am so grateful for all of you for establishing a committee to work on dismantling racism and for passing the Reparations Action Fund plan. This will bring congregations and people together in this very important work. I am so excited about the next part of my journey and so grateful to have others walking it with me.
On the nights when I remember to pray with Ansel before bed, I often end with this. God, show us where you are at work in the world and give us the courage to join in. This prayer stems from my belief in the already and not yet nature of the kingdom of God. By that I mean, I believe that God is currently at work in our world, that we can and ought to be participants in creating the kind of upside down world that Jesus taught. And God's kingdom is not yet here in its fullness, but one day will be. I certainly don't need to articulate how dark these days are, how far we seem to be from any kind of world that God imagined. But living in this tension of acknowledging the darkness while walking toward and hoping for the light is one belief I continually return to time and time again. To be honest, I'm not always convinced the light will come. Some days this is a harder belief to hold than others. And on those days, I stand by believing that God is with us here now. We must only have eyes to see what God is currently doing and then courage or maybe humility to join in. Last summer, our family walked through the Blue Ridge Tunnel in Virginia. The tunnel is roughly 3/4 of a mile long, so a headlamp is recommended to get through the damp and cold path. As we walked into the darkness, you could see a tiny light at the other side. But I found that the more I strained to see the distant light, the harder it was for my eyes to adjust to the present dark. As we walked on, I found myself looking back to see one spot of light shrinking and looking forward, desperate to see the other grow. I don't particularly like the dark or confined spaces. So add dripping wet rocks and my toddler screaming, "I hear my echo," over and over and over again. Well, it was a bit of sensory overload and I wanted out immediately. We made it the whole way through and back again without it caving in on us. But afterwards, I continued thinking about how looking at the light made it harder to adjust to the dark. I grew up with a faith that told me that heaven was the main goal. Getting into heaven, getting other people into heaven. There was so much focus on the light at the other end of the tunnel that I think we maybe lost sight of where we are. It seems that if we look for the light too quickly, it keeps us from being present in the dark. If we are constantly dreaming of things being better one day, how will our eyes adjust to the present moment? When I stopped looking back and forward, straining for any light I could find from the middle of the tunnel, I pointed my headlamp above me, and to my surprise, the rocks were shimmering all around me. I recognize how cliche this analogy is, but the image continues to help me. It seems we will always be in a kaleidoscope of light and dark, shifting shafts of sunlight, shimmering rocks, damp tunnels. And I think the trick might be learning how to see clearly. How to take in both the long view of the kingdom coming and the present circumstance of the not yet. I believe in being present in the dark while holding on to hope for the light. I believe in searching for the shimmering ways God is moving now while recognizing that our efforts now are just that, shimmers of what's to come. God, show us where you're at work in the world and give us the courage to join in.
This, I believe, beauty has healing properties. O beauty, ever ancient, ever new, late have I loved you. You were with me, but I was not with you. These words are from a prayer by St. Augustine, and they remind us that beauty has always existed, and yet we can miss it. As a young adult, I remember hearing the folk singer Jim Croger sing the song, "Why Do We Hunger for Beauty?" Some of you might know that song too. It doesn't answer the question, although I believe the answer is that we find healing, hope, joy, and beauty, however we define it. My belief in the healing properties of beautiful things was likely planted in me in childhood as I watched my dear mother lovingly care for petunias, geraniums, irises, marigolds, bleeding hearts, and of course, roses. After she died, I realized how strongly her love of beautiful things, including beautiful flowers, lived on in my sisters and me, and that was a healing moment in our grief. In my work as a psychotherapist, on a virtual session, a client who gave me permission to share this story and who has been mired in deep, complicated grief after the death of her adult son a few years ago showed me with delight a bouquet of sunflowers she had bought for herself. "He used to always buy me these," she said, "because he knew they were my favorite flowers." Her face glowed. Which didn't happen very often. And I could see that for that moment, she felt joy and healing in her grief. In fact, there are increasing number of studies, maybe you know this, showing that appreciation of beauty and experiences of awe can lower anxiety and depression and also reduce risks of diabetes, heart disease, and many other illnesses. It's not a small thing that this can do. I recently attended a silent retreat with a group, and sitting at breakfast, I was suddenly overcome. And I am again. By the awareness and reminder of all the people, including children, who have been remembering me and praying for me and supporting me in many ways in this cancer treatment journey that I am on. The tears came and I allowed them and their healing power to just flow over me for a time. It was a beautiful moment of connection and gratitude, not the first one and I'm sure not the last one. I am known and loved. Also at that retreat, on a lovely fall weather day, I was able to lie outside under a tree and be rained on by yellow leaves when a gust of wind blew in. Seeing the falling leaves as they fell on my face and arms, feeling the air that guided them, all caused me to breathe deeply. I felt my soul, body, and mind soften and relax. It was a healing moment. Environmentalist Rachel Carson wrote, "Those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts." I agree with that. Often when outside on a walk, I am drawn to look at the sky and I can't resist taking pictures of it, and not just at sunset. I asked myself recently why I do this. I am drawn by the vastness of the wide sky, the unending variations of clouds, colors, and light. John O'Donohue addresses this with these words, "To behold beauty heals you and calls you out of the smallness of your own self-limitation to experience new horizons. To experience beauty is to have your life enlarged." I recall an overwhelmingly beautiful moment years ago. I was sitting in a choir concert by the Goshen College Women's World Music Choir. I don't think it exists anymore, but I'm not sure. And they stood around the edges of the church, circling the audience, and I can't say what song they were singing, but what I remember is closing my eyes and letting the ethereal music flow over me. I didn't want it to end. And at some level, I felt met and healed in those moments. We've all heard beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and indeed, I believe that is true. Author Catherine May wrote, "The all-inspiring, the numinous is all around us all the time. It is transformed by our deliberate attention. It becomes valuable when we value it." It isn't hard these days to find pain, grief, destruction, and despair all around us. So my wish is that we may open ourselves to beauty in all its forms by paying attention, because it is there for all of us, and it is a deep source of healing. This I believe. Imagine a circle of women arranged in age from oldest to youngest, or youngest to oldest, slowly walking around in a circle and singing this Native American prayer. Now I walk in beauty. Beauty is before me. Beauty is behind me, above and below me. I know some of you were in that circle at CMCO Women's Retreat, and I would invite you to stand, and if you know the song, sing along with me, and if you don't, you might learn it pretty soon. Please stand.
Now I walk in beauty. Beauty is before me. Beauty is behind me, above and below me. Now I walk in beauty. Beauty is before me.
All find ways to walk in beauty. Thank you.
Ellen and Ashley and Marty, thank you so much for this morning. The beauty, the light, the aha moments, the sacredness of your stories. Thank you so much.